like scary movies?
Uh-huh. I'm getting ready to watch a video.
You making popcorn?
Uh-huh.
What's your favorite?
I don't know.
You have to have a favorite. Talk to me. Talk to me.
Hi, everybody. I'm George, and welcome to the Best Little Horror House in Philly, the show where we talk about the best horror movie ever made, according to our guest, at least. And today, the best horror podcast for comics fans is back, because we're talking with the delightful Pete Fakey. Welcome, Pete. How's it going?
Excellent. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you. I really, really love your work. I was introduced to it through the double issue that you did with my buddy A.T.
Yeah,
Pratt.
Yeah. Double Digest. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, really awesome stuff. And I'm just thrilled to get you in here. You're a dyed-in-the-wool horror fan. It's obvious. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your history with horror, where it all started for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was always kind of part of my life. My dad's a big horror guy, and he's like huge on like Universal Monster movies. He always told this story about talking his grandma into taking him to go see the Wolfman when he wasn't allowed to go see the Wolfman because everybody knew he was going to be too scared to sleep.
Sure.
And then he was too scared to sleep, you know, but like he loved that story. He loves the Wolfman still, you know. He hasn't gotten the notice that Lon Chaney is everyone's least favorite Universal actor. So that was kind of always present, but I was like a really scared kid. Like I tried to get through Jurassic Park probably 6 or 7 times around when I was 6 years old, and I couldn't get past the T-Rex, you know, just couldn't do it.
They're the hero.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I wanted to see the dinosaurs so bad. Like, so, just couldn't do it. I couldn't help it.
You know, that's such a funny one because I watched it really young at an age where you'd think that I would have been scared by it, and I wasn't scared. And then when I came back to it, I was like, oh, this is fucking scary. Like, it was like 3 years later. I was probably like 7 or so, and I was like, oh, this is fucked up, and I'm like really like frightened of the acid spitting.
Dude, and I remember. Yeah, yeah. And I remember people like kids on the playground talking about like the severed arm on the shoulder.
Yeah.
And then she moves out and it reveals itself. And I'm like, there's no way they put that in a movie. That's too scary. Like nobody can do that, you know?
Who authorized this?
Yeah, yeah. But I finally like really took the dive around middle school, classic video store rental days with your friends. And I still was not really on board. I was hanging on to that residual fear, you know? So Friday the 13th Part 1 was my first, like, real horror movie. And after that, I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. This is, you know... And then it's, like, all in and never look back. And, yeah, it's everywhere.
Hell yeah. Well, very relatable, both from the Universal Monster stuff. You know, I'm a big fan of Universal Monsters myself. And then Friday the 13th was my sort of dip into the water as well when I was deciding to get into horror and saying I need to just like embrace the genre. I think it's just a great one to start with. It has the perfect level of like genuine tension, but also like is like the corny like 80s slasher.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And it's I mean, especially when you're like old enough to have an awareness of like how obvious the practical effects are special effects.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're fucking awesome, you know, but they're obviously special effects.
Sure.
And you're expecting to like have that same experience you had when you're 6 years old and you're like, oh fuck, that T-Rex, like I'm done for, you know? But then you go in and you sit down and you see all these special effects, you're like, oh man, this is actually amazing.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm in good hands here. I'm in good hands.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite subgenre?
Well, it definitely used to be slashers, and I still definitely have a soft spot for them. And especially like I think like Friday 2 is like kind of the platonic ideal of a slasher, partially because like so much of that movie is just watching people live their lives pre-internet.
Right.
You know, last time I watched it, I was like, oh shit, you just got to like sit down and read a magazine and it's like a 5-minute scene, you know? I love that shit, dude. Like 5-10 minutes of nothing fucking happening, just teenagers hanging out.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't even want the action to get rolling until like 45 minutes in. I want 45 minutes of nothing in my slasher.
Yeah.
You know?
There's that scene where one of them is like, shit, we did everything there is to do here already.
Hell yeah. Yeah. So I love that stuff. I think probably kind of what I'm gravitating to right now is, I guess I would say like a grindhouse, not necessarily like a clean subgenre, but like I'm just way into that kind of like Wild West horror movie era, and especially like no budget, got really into Bleeding Skull.
Mm-hmm.
You know, apropos of what we're talking about today, But yeah, just that kind of, I think on your Q episode, I forgot who the guest was on there, but he was talking about that experience of a movie where like you're not expecting much and then you sit down and it's like an incredible experience.
Yeah.
Doesn't get better than that, you know?
Definitely. I totally agree. Yeah. That was Branson Reese. I think hit the nail on the head, especially when, you know, as you become further removed in time from these movies, and it sort of mm-hmm. just becomes like the past, right? It doesn't feel like a real time period where people had struggles in their own, like, it's like real. And I feel like some of these movies that are, especially on a lower budget side, do mm-hmm. capture the veritas of just like the struggle of making it in these times. And I just think that, yeah, they're such an interesting, self-made often.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I really love about that Grindhouse era, too, is all that's true, but a lot of it, like, it was still a time where, like, people would just crank out, like, a piece of shit. Like, Herschel Gordon Lewis, I don't remember if this is actually a quote I read from him or not, but I put it on the portrait I did of him because I was like, well, who gives a shit, you know? But the quote was, the movie poster is more important than the movie itself.
That's right. You know?
So it was this era where it's like you can go out, no budget, crank a movie out, not really that worried about it, and you can run that as like a weird little like con and like actually make a buck doing it. And those days are just so far gone. I think it makes for like a very specific and interesting kind of like accidentally experimental art.
Yeah, you could beat the news of it being terrible to the next town.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, totally. So sick.
So the movie we're talking about is a fascinating one. It's The Curious Dr. Hump, written and directed originally as La Venganza del Sexo by Emilio Vieira, then imported to the U.S. and edited together with new footage by Gerald Intrator. And this is, as you sort of alluded to, a particularly fascinating time in movies. It's right on the cusp of the 70s, where basically anything can get distributed. And it creates this weird, nebulous blend of high art and low art, where they sort of meld into each other and become mm-hmm. neither and both.
Totally, man. I'm glad we're on the same page. I spent all day being like, am I going to have to convince him that this is actually like really smart?
No,
you know?
No,
I straight up think this is a very like legitimately good movie. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was intentional, but I think it's really good.
It really is. And, you know, I've been watching through the Black Emmanuel series, which is a great example. Sure. But even something like The Exorcist or Saturday Night Fever, I think both capture this sort of combination that I'm talking about.
Yeah, interesting.
And this comes about because of the proliferation of on-screen sexuality. So I thought that it might be interesting to discuss the path that leads to both that environment and The Curious Dr. Hump specifically.
Yeah, hit me.
I do want to first shout out Frank Hennenlotter, who not only did the commentary for the American Genre Film Archive release of Dr. Hump, but also put together an amusing documentary, clearly a passion project, called That's Sexploitation, with famed producer David F. Friedman. Very informative pair with a lot of firsthand accounts related to Dr. Hump and just being in the genre. So definitely recommend those to people.
And Friedman was he was a major collaborator with Herschel Gordon Lewis, right?
Right.
That's the same Friedman?
Yep, yeah. Yep. So in the 20s, movies were the number one entertainment form and began to sort of transcend theaters as people bought home 16mm projectors. And now that they're showing things privately, this boosts the desire for more risque content. So loops of women showing various levels of skin started to emerge, like 1929's Why Girls Walk Home. Now, Will Hayes, former Postmaster General, established at the request of studio heads like Adolf Zukor and William Fox, an association of producers and distributors. But the actual code that he's famous for, the Hays Code, wasn't actually established until around 1933, when the Legion of Decency, an arm of the Catholic Church, came up with a list of do's and don'ts. No nudity in silhouette or form whatsoever, no married couples sharing a bed, that sort of thing. Scandalous, to be sure. And
yeah.
The production association agreed to abide by the Hays Code in an effort to avoid actual enforced national censorship.
Yeah.
But the ironic thing is, the push for quote-unquote decency in film, as with everything, had an equal but opposite reaction, leading to the people less interested in adhering to Catholic moralism creating and watching exploitation films. Movies about the use of marijuana, of roadhouses, of prostitution, anything and everything considered bad taste, though to avoid more localized censorship and legal issues, they were often propped up with flimsy warnings about the topics, which is where the famous sex hygiene films come into play.
Those warnings are like their own little gemstones, you know?
There is a real ironic, detached enjoyment that I get out of watching a lot of the PSA stuff.
Yeah.
I've been watching the Ormond Family set. They did a bunch of basically like
Christian
exploitation movies that are all about like, oh shit, dude, you're going to hell if you do all this bad stuff. And if you're a communist, watch out. And it's like,
right.
Oh, we have all these costumes. We want to put on a play about hell, basically. we need to fund it by selling these. It's really, really great stuff.
It sounds a little bit like those stories. I've never seen one, but those stories of like Catholic haunted houses, and it's all scenes of hell, but they have like this reputation of being like among the most gory haunted houses, you know?
Yeah, oh, they're going.
Shit rules, man.
These movies, though, weren't exactly being nationally distributed, though. So the 40 Thieves, as the infamous exploiteers of the time, like Dwayne Esper, were known, schlepped from town to town trying to convince theaters to screen them. And these movies were a mess because you'd be cutting things for certain states that were fine for others and vice versa. So you'd wind up with a ton of different prints or shoot like a hot and a cool version. Makes it really tough for archivists, which is kind of an interesting issue that hadn't, I mean, they no one was thinking like, oh, in 100 years, people will want to be watching these movies still.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and if you want more info on those different cuts and just the arbitrary nature of it, check out Lloyd Kaufman. Boy, once you get this guy talking, he's listened to a bunch of interviews with him. Once you get this guy talking, he will not stop and he will not shut up about how much he got censored and how like arbitrary it was. And
yeah, man.
He's still ringing that bell.
Hey, I mean, it's easy. I mean, I kind of understand. Like, that's the kind of thing that would really leave a bitter taste in my mouth for sure. So.
Yeah.
World War II was rough for exploitation filmmakers, as you can imagine. First off, much of their audience was called away, and then censorship was at an all-time high, with local boards seemingly determined to not let America rot away thanks to the evils of movies by the time the military men returned. So printed matter became big, as seen with the lasting impact of the emergent pinup girl. But the filmmakers still made short loops for arcade peep shows. There was also a really funny mention in the documentary about how Germany had been producing so many nudist camp films because Hitler wanted to encourage a new generation of cannon fodder.
Wow, man. You just keep hearing more and more about these guys, and it only gets weirder.
Yeah.
I didn't realize what a speed freak he was and like how much just speed they were like putting their resources into producing. All right.
It's a self-perpetuating cycle, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely.
As World War II raged, the hygiene film returned at a new level of explicitness, disease-riddled penises aplenty, with movies like USSVD, Ship of Shame.
All right, well, I think I may need to check that one out. Title like that, I mean, shit, that'll get me through the door.
Amazing title. Wasn't exactly a pleasure cruise, but the audience was there. In fact, according to the documentary, Kroger Babb's childbirth film Mom and Dad took in over $60 million in 1945, which would be about $1.25 billion today, putting it in the top 25 highest-grossing films of all time, right above Iron Man 3.
Straight up, dude. And that's honestly, like, as ridiculous as that fact is, I think it's a really important point for why exploitation movies matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's this like other side of the coin. It's like an invisible market almost. Mm-hmm. Studios never really want to acknowledge this stuff, but like they make fucking money and they really influence culture.
Absolutely. And as the military men returned home and we hit the 50s, exploiteers realized that they could plop a camera in the fourth row of a burlesque show and film the whole thing easy peasy, and it was just game over. Burlesque exploded in popularity, not only live but filmed for private consumption. And this was pretty much the only game in town for much of the 50s, except for a few flashes of something germane to this conversation, which is that nudity could be found in, quote, art house movies that were really foreign imports more explicit than the American Motion Picture Board would allow. And this persists through the 60s, with a Variety article in 1969 talking about the way the auspices of foreign film allowed people to flock and see the same film in an art house that they wouldn't go near in a sex house.
Hmm.
Now, slightly tangential, but relevant to general American taste and emerging sexuality on screen, the AFI has clocked around 900 sexploitation movies made in the 60s. But the decade saw a lot of change within the genre. There were over 700 theaters focused on sexploitation, so everybody who realized that you could make a fortune renting a camera and models for a few hours rushed out to do just that, leading to a glut of sloppy films and eventually the roughies, where crazed men lashed out with abuse, torture, and murder of nude women, truly the antithesis of the innocent nudie cuties of the early 60s,
mm-hmm.
which put women on a look-but-don't-touch pedestal of goo-goo eyes and dumb comedy.
Kind of coinciding with the same time period where you're getting, like, these same kind of like sadomasochistic detective magazines, like really booming. Something in the water, I guess.
Yeah. And the end of this decade is when the transition to actual hardcore began. Instead of actual theaters, which by definition had closer to 100 seats, people would set up storefronts with 40 or so seats in the back, and these smaller, intimate venues drove the content further. And in 1970, Man and Wife was another medical hygiene film, but now it showed the full, real deal for about 30 seconds.
Huh, no shit, I've never heard of that one.
Yeah, so the first hardcore film in theaters, and it led to another peak in the cycle for hygiene films slash marital manual movies, but the beginning of the end for sexploitation movies, as hardcore pornography became the norm and mainstream films began to depict sex consuming the market for sexploitation. So the sort of stratification and pulling in the two opposite directions is basically what destroyed this subgenre.
Yeah, and you see that over and over again with exploitation movies where it kind of just becomes too successful to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
And then studios just kind of fold it into what they're already doing. There's a Grindhouse documentary. I haven't seen it in a while. I watched it a few times when I was in college, but I think John Landis is on there talking about how Jaws was kind of the final nail in the coffin for the exploitation era,
mm-hmm.
where he's like, this is a studio movie, pretty good size budget, pretty good size special effects, you know, and this is just an exploitation movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing about this that isn't an exploitation. And now it's a classic,
right?
You know?
Yeah, the only thing that's different between that and Razorback or that and Grizzly is the fact that a bazillion people saw it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, as far as The Curious Dr. Hump, it exists in the sweet spot, for me, where the form had been around long enough to have been established, rejecting sexualities needing to hide behind the hygiene film of the decades prior, and get some popularity and funding so that we actually still know about it, but not so deep in the timeline that sort of the evidence of the decline is there. There is still sort of an innocence to this, I think, that comes from both the country of origin and also being made like right on the cusp of it becoming the era of the roughies.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and speaking of you kind of mentioned it earlier about these movies kind of working as a time capsule,
mm-hmm.
in some respects. I was really thinking about that watching this last night. Like, in our world of like instant porn, everyone has like the largest library of porn ever collected, right, in their pocket at all times. It's so hard to imagine like needing this movie to actually function as sexually arousing,
right?
You know, and you really don't get that perspective with other genres,
right?
You know.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also like, oh, I have to go like watch this porno with the boys down at the VFA.
Yeah, totally, man.
And then come home to my wife. Boy.
Hell yeah.
So Venganza del Sexo was shot in Argentina with less than 2 weeks in 1966 as a quiet, fairly tame horror movie that certainly dealt with sex but balanced the censorship of the Argentine government and Emilio's own right-wing views.
Oh, interesting.
As Frank describes it in the commentary, the Foundation movie is, quote, perversely old-fashioned. Despite all the skin on display, it's basically a cautionary tale about sexual excess. Men are depleted and turned into stone-faced automatons or thrown into a fiery pit, and women are turned into nymphomaniacs.
Did you watch the Argentine cut?
Yeah, I did. It's It's interesting. I think that the difference in just how much dialogue there is the most noticeable mm-hmm. thing to me. It is mm-hmm. really quiet. And it does, I think, there are moments where I think it works better, and there are moments where I think the dubbing works better. You know, the fact that they kind of let it linger on a lot of these shots and kind of build that atmosphere works with the sort of dispassion that the Doctor demonstrates and everything.
Right.
But there's also, I mean, some of the dialogue is effectively eerie. And I'm like, oh, I like this mm-hmm. better, that they're, like, talking about being fucking weirdos here.
In the Argentine version?
No, in the American, the Dr. Hump cut, as opposed to Venganza del Sexo.
Yeah, the first time I saw this, I watched the Dr. Hump cut, and, you know, we'll get into it in a minute, but boy, they sure do cut a lot of softcore into this movie.
Yeah.
It's really, they lay it on thick. And I fully expected to like the Venganza cut better, assuming that it was going to be more of this kind of like traditional monster movie with some spice, you know? But after watching it, I was like, God damn, if all that softcore doesn't like really add this element of surrealism that I think really elevates the idea and the plot behind this movie. So I did not expect like 20, 25 minutes of extraneous stripping and dry humping to make the movie better, but I really think it does.
Yeah, I honestly do agree. Gerald Introtor was going to distribute it in the U.S. with a 1970 release date, and he said, the U.S. market, the rapidly changing taste, we gotta get some sexy inserts in here, baby. And he edited them in, I think, with a really impressively deft hand. And I think that that's kind of what makes it work for me, is that it's not like, okay, here we are, time to watch the porno inserts. It's like, it does feel incorporated into the movie. And it doesn't need to be anything crazy. There's just moments where, like, in an insert shot, there's like the shadow of a scary hand on the wall.
Pretty impressive, man. I'm like wondering where they sourced that from.
Yeah.
Like, did they shoot that for this?
Yeah.
Did they pull it from like a different, they did shoot it
for
it?
Yeah, that was what Frank gave the impression of, at least, is that he said, they literally just said, you know, this will be the transition. This is how we connect and how we sew these two things together. Mm-hmm. And I think that it really works. I do think that sort of having these moments of sexuality in the movie do elevate the idea. You know, that it is the kind of thing where it's like, first of all, it's not like a crazy long movie, even with the added footage.
I know. So, I know. With the fluff, it's an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for them to sort of linger on these moments and let you engage with the idea that there is a vitality to it, right? That he is trying to steal this life force from people. And so if you are like, yeah, this is life, this is passion, this is the heat of being alive, I think that it definitely works to benefit the movie.
Yeah, and I think on like a conceptual level, kind of aside from the plot, I think it does a couple of really interesting things too. One of them, and you notice this in the sound design a lot too, it creates this like very collage, like focused experience for the movie. Mm-hmm. It has this, it's very much a collaborative effort, you know, between this original film and then this new cut.
Right.
And I think the other thing that it does is it's so, I'm going to say relentless, especially in that first like 5-10 minutes. It's just kind of relentless with the cut-ins that it really quickly, I think, just kind of fades into the setting.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's not even like, we're not even really watching, like, it functions almost like a landscape, like an establishing shot, you know, and it just becomes of the world that we're living in here. Like, everyone is horny, everyone is fucking, that's your baseline, you know? And on that, then you get to build off of that and start to explore some of these other ideas.
Right. And like you were saying, you know, it is genuinely just building on the original foundational film. It doesn't feel particularly recycled. It feels like extended upon. And the opening scenes of the Venganza del Sexo still are like the stripping scene. Like, it is still very much like what they're doing with the movie. So So definitely a collaborative effort that blends horror and sexploitation into The Curious Case of Dr. Hum.
Which is a perfect combination for me. Mm-hmm. If you're like me, this is dead center in your Venn diagram of what you're trying to check out on a Friday night.
One of the additional actors includes Kim Pope, a very famous sexploitation actress in the 70s. She plays the nymphomaniac, and at the beginning, Hennenlotter provided a lot of backstory about the briefly visible vibrator that she's using, the Oscar Stimulax Massager from 1939, whose vintage ad promised it made an ideal Christmas gift and carried the Good Housekeeping seal of approval.
What would we do without Frank Hennenlotter? We'd be lost. We'd be completely lost.
The man is a treasure, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also will say, while we're on the topic of sort of comparing Venganza del Sexo and The Curious Dr. Hump, one of the things that I am sad that they cut is the really delightful title sequence. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's in Spanish, so they cut it for the English release, but it has this really cool, like, Saul Bassian vibe that I was really enjoying. Mm. Definite perk to having Venganza del Sexo included on the disc.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really glad that they have both on there. Yeah, I remember prior to last night, the last time I'd watched it was the Venganza cut, and I remember watching it last night and being like, huh, I remember that opening title being like having a little more oomph to it.
Other actors include Alda Barbeo as Dr. Hump and Susana Beltran as his nurse/assistant, unnamed in the movie.
Did you catch a lot of names? No. I think the only name I caught was Dr. Hump.
Well, one of the reporters named George, so I did. I said, hey, oh, that's yeah. me.
Well, there you go. Well, that'll keep you invested in the movie.
Exactly. Now, originally, Dr. Hump was known as Dr. Zoida, which was a punny variation on spermatocyte. And when they were discussing mm-hmm. why they changed the name, it's as simple as because it's a funny name that would help them get noticed to call it Dr. Hump. And they're fucking right. Fun. It's a great-ass name.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
But why is Dr. Hump so curious, you might ask? In 1967, a Swedish import called I Am Curious Yellow was a landmark obscenity case that had huge ripples on the mainstream release. Now, when Jimmy on the street hears about this insane obscenity case, he goes, oh, wow, this must be the dirtiest movie ever made. And Frank even talked about how hype he got when he went to go see it, and they actually carted him. He said, oh, this was going to be crazy. And then it turned out to be a fairly boring movie about Swedish politics that did have a few softcore sex scenes, but certainly nothing insanely titillating. But because of this, for a while, the word curious became a buzzword linked to sex, which inspired titles like I Am Curious Tahiti, The Curious Female, and I Am Curious Gay, with Dr. Hump leaning in so hard its tagline was even the most curious picture of them all. I Am Curious Yellow was so in the zeitgeist that DC called a story in an issue of Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane, I Am Curious Black, wherein she changes her skin color for 24 hours.
No shit. I knew about that issue, but I did not know that connection. Yeah. That is fascinating. I also think it's fucking nuts that Curious became like the sex version of Holocaust for cannibal movies. Mm. That is nuts.
Yeah, for sure. Now, Dr. Hump was released here in 1970 with sort of this sell sex campaign. They were really leaning on that. The image of the one sheet was the hippie girl leaning in front of the hippie guy. No indicator of the sci-fi or horror aspects. As Hennenlotter put it, it looked like a movie about a blowjob, which had difficulty getting into mainstream newspapers and whatnot.
And then you go in and it's just like fucking big old paper mache heads all over the place. What the fuck am I watching? That rules, man. I love these fucking... It's such a like...
Sell the sizzle, like, baby. Sell the sizzle.
Yeah, man. No scruples. None. You know?
Yep.
Get him in the door, that's it.
That's right. So the movie did come and go, it sort of faded from view. As far as Venganza del Sexo, it had a poor reception because of the censorship-heavy environment it was released into, which, you know, that'll have a cultural impact as well.
Mm-hmm.
But as the grip loosened, and a new generation pushed back, it did have a bit of a resurrection during the 80s, as did many filmmakers who sort of pushed the boundaries of the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back in New York, Movie Lab catered to East Coast independent filmmakers, developing movies, doing subtitles, that sort of thing. And when they closed, thanks to the recession of 1990 and an industry facing globalization issues, a basement full of film elements was abandoned, then sold by the custodial staff for $200 per film, which is just so fucking funny.
Yeah, the bad old days.
There was a huge section of perfect condition sexploitation movies dismissed by the janitors as shit, but a feast for Hennenlotter and his something weird pals.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Dude, those photos of, I'm forgetting his name now, the main guy running something weird
Mike,
for
I think?
Decades. Yeah, yeah, those photos of him smoking a cigarette, digging through celluloid, legendary.
So great. Hey, he's lucky that shit didn't go up in flames with that cig.
It's insane, yeah, and he's in like a fucking like 6-foot box in a basement somewhere, you know.
Yeah, I have that book, that something weird book. I haven't gotten a chance to really dig through it yet, but one of yeah. these years, I like have it planned that I'm going to do like a New Year's resolution of like read through and watch the movies with the book. So that's, I think that'll be
hell
fun.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Yeah.
But yeah, so it's not just prints, but actual negatives of such hits as The Pink Pussy, Devil in High Heels, and our pal, The Curious Dr. Hum. So they gave the head custodian $5,000 to just walk away and let them take what they wanted. And the guy said without batting an eye, let me show you where the elevator is and turn off the lights when you're done. And they never saw the janitors again.
Hell yeah. Man, I wish you could still get away with shit like that. You probably can somewhere, you know, yeah. But boy, that's a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And even more once in a lifetime, none of them were copyrighted, especially because back then you had to actually send a print of your movie to the Library of Congress, which was an easy mm-hmm. sort of no thank you expenditure line for low budget movies, especially ones with the short shelf life of nudie flicks and the risk of that same government coming after them with obscenity charges as far as they were concerned.
Fully intent on throwing this thing in the trash when the theater runs done. Right. You know, why copyright it?
Right.
Yeah.
So the copyright on the title card was a fake. Something Weird put it out on VHS as one of Frank's sexy shockers from the vault, and it sold like hotcakes. A mutual friend of Frank and Emilio's told Emilio about it being resurrected on home video, and there was an article in an Argentinian newspaper about a crazy cult filmmaker in America who had rediscovered the film, which is Frank. And so on a brief trip to New York City, Emilio wanted to meet Frank, and they got along great. But the producer, who played the bartender, was there too, and he was pissed that Movie Lab didn't contact him about the negative. And he got madder and madder, and then threatened to have goons take back the film in the middle of the night. And Frank was like, what can I say, except I lived my life in constant fear.
Oh, man. Gotta love it.
So let's get into the actual movie. It opens on the lumbering gait of some metal-plated shoes that immediately call to mind Frankenstein's monster.
Totally.
Frank jumped in right away and said, uh-oh, scary feet are coming towards us. And scary feet means there's a scary guy attached to them. Well, that's the way it usually is, but not here. Just so immediate.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
There are a lot of gothic elements in this movie that I really, really respond to. It sort of ties to that presaging the 70s high art, low art blend that I was talking about in sort of combining the sexual revolution that was happening in the 60s with that 30s gothic horror.
Mm-hmm.
It just really, really works for me. The fact that this is literally like the first thing you see is these lumbering Frankenstein feet. It's just
totally.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah. So good. Great. Great way to start a movie. Any movie that starts on lumbering Frankenstein feet, I'm sticking around.
Yeah, you earn yourself a lot of leash with that.
Yeah, totally.
This large man approaches a smooching couple and ethers them, sliding them into a hearse, as we see he has two compatriots with similar dress and build. This great jazz score kicks in. The music by Victor Buccino. Oh my god, dude fucking pops off in this movie.
Uh-huh. I was really paying attention to the soundtrack and kind of the sound collages throughout this movie more so last night. Mm-hmm. And I was like, damn, there's like a whole other element going on here that I wasn't really keyed into before.
Yeah. At one point there's like, I think he's just like clicking a pen in the sound, like in the mix. And I was like, oh fuck,
yeah,
that's working for me, dude.
Dude, it's crazy. Yeah. Did you, on that opening scene where he sneaks up on the couple making out.
Sneaks.
Did that?
In quotes.
Yeah. Well, they're completely oblivious. Far too horny to notice anything else. Did that register for you as, like, too long? Like, they're making out a little too hard for a little too long for, like, a movie from this era? Mm. Did that ping for you at all?
You know, I think that looking back at it, like now that you've mentioned it, I kind of see it and kind of feel that way. I don't know if it triggered anything for me just like watching it, but
sure.
I mean, it is kind of a long sequence, and it part of that feels a little like, oh, it's just because it's a low budget movie, and they're like, we need to use every sure. fucking scrap sure. of film that we have on this.
Yeah, yeah.
But definitely it is kind of just like a lingering atmospheric movie. So I think I kind of just chalked it up to that.
Sure. Yeah. When I was watching it yesterday, and the reason I ask is because it like really stood out to me. And I'm like, is that just because I've seen it six fucking times? And now I'm like looking for all these little details. Yeah. But it does that a few times. And to your point with that kind of lingering atmosphere, that scene specifically with... It's very surreal with this guy
yeah.
sneaking up, stomping up, and it's, you know, they don't bury the lead at all. It's just you cut to the, or no, they don't reveal the face yet in
it's
that scene,
bit,
do they?
Yeah,
it's just,
it
it's like
bit.
Shoulder down. Yeah.
They just
yeah.
show you he's a big fucking dude.
Yeah, yeah. But then with that extra long beat, it had like a little bit to me, just like a hint of like a Twin Peaks-y kind of like, we're just going to linger a little too long. We're going to give you a little too much atmosphere. And like, aside from the obviously weird, there's nothing too far out of the ordinary, except we're just going a little too long.
Yeah.
You know,
that's really interesting. I definitely think that it works that way. Even if they weren't doing it on purpose, it sort of
totally don't think it was intentional.
Yeah. It does, based on our own expectations of like the film form mm-hmm. of like, how long would it take for them to get to this guy, like attacking them? It definitely sort of pushes you to be patient. And I think that is a
yeah,
good
totally.
Thing for a movie of this era to sort of establish up top, like, hey, dog, you got to sort of be willing to sit through a scene for this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely got to be willing to sit through a scene for this movie.
Two women in a house, they get undressed and smooch. This is juxtaposed with the approaching hearse and the men who emerge. One opens the door, shocking them not just with his presence, but also with his fucked up face.
Ah. Yeah, there's his fucked up face. Dude, so good. So good. Mm-hmm. I like, all I want is a black and white movie with a big papier-mâché head. You know?
Definitely.
I'm set.
Yeah, you know, Hennenlotter described this as a movie that seemed to escape from the comics. And I think that this mask
totally.
Is a
yeah.
huge part of it. It is cartoonish and bizarre in a way that feels so surreal in the fact that everyone just kind of like responds to it normally. Like, they're definitely like, oh,
yeah,
he's a monster.
Totally.
But they're never like, yeah. holy shit, like, this dude is insanely fucked up. When he walks into the bar, everyone's just like, this is a little strange.
Yeah, yeah. Start to finish, the entire movie, everyone's just like, there he is. Yeah. You know? Just. The other thing that I really, really love about this movie, too, there's a total lack of, like, self-conscious embarrassment with that monster design that I think you see in other, you know, giant bug movies, or you'll see it sometimes on, like, Outer Limits, where they have this big build-up, and then they go to reveal the monster, and, like, they kind of know it doesn't look very good, so they're kind of, like, trying not to show it too much. These guys, they're fucking giving you close-ups. There's no attempt to hide the face at any moment. Mm. The monsters are just kind of, again, part of that atmosphere, yeah. part of the environment.
Yeah, one of them is even a real-ass character. He's, like, got a love arc.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. I love it, man. I love just, you know, no embarrassment whatsoever. It's just, this is what we got for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, so these monsters definitely feel comics-y. I also think that the framing itself occasionally feels like comic panels. They do a really interesting mm-hmm. job of kind of keeping the composition pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I noticed that a lot watching movies, and every time I catch it, and especially if a movie's very heavy in it, it goes up on the list real quick. Mm-hmm. And specifically while we're talking about comics, I think this movie could just be a Gilbert Hernandez story in Love and Rockets. I don't think you would have to change a single fucking thing, except maybe make the tits bigger. Other than that, it's just a Gilbert Hernandez comic. If you're into his work, you should seek this movie out, because it's a real treat.
Absolutely. and nobody is safe from these monsters. A young man stumbling out of a bar. A bunch of youths smoking weed and hooking up. A woman mid-masturbation from the comfort of her coated in pinups bedroom. 10 kidnappings in 10 days. Unheard of.
Yeah, and the editing on this sequence with the Dr. Hump cut, I think, is fascinating because it's such hard cuts back and forth. It is really disorienting, you know?
Yeah.
One of the notes I took was like, this movie is coming at you a mile a minute and also nothing is really happening. It's a, it's kind of a bizarre, like, double whatever going on there.
Absolutely. It is kind of a weird dissonance, right? Feels very fast paced and also very slow and methodical at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
The press is pressing the cops, who have no leads, but Inspector Benedict is approached by newspaper man George, who suggests that this is connected to a mad scientist in Italy who performed crazy eugenic style improve the human race experiments on the sexual aberrations of women after the strange disappearance of the area's men and pretty girls. Some kind of sexperiments.
Hell yeah, man. I'm good work. That rules. Did you catch, I don't think it's at this part of the movie, I think it's later on, I just caught it this first time, I think the Italian doctor is like Dr. Poon something. Like, it's like a play on like Poontang or Poonani or some shit like that, and they just sneak it in.
That's right.
The way the dub delivers it, it's almost like they don't want to say it.
You know? Those rascals know exactly what they're doing.
To me, it felt like he was embarrassed. He was like, come on, guys.
The inspector is called away, but he asks for the file that this man dug up. And finally, we see the lab of Dr. Hump, which is a classic in every sense. He reveals himself from behind a skull on a stack of books, aka the equivalent of a diploma from Mad Doctor School.
Couldn't be cooler.
Yeah. Also at his desk are some mice, bubbling flasks and boiling beakers, anatomy posters. It is, if you're like a horror of the 30s fan, this is really gonna hit a sweet spot. The camera also reveals a lovely brain in a jar on the table, which you gotta love. Especially since at this point, you're just like, oh, sweet, brain in a jar. Like, you don't realize that that's gonna come back.
Dude, monster head on screen at all times, opening on monster feet, we're already doing great. Now you give me a brain in a jar? Come on, man. You're spoiling me here.
That's right. The doctor drinks something of his own creation. A drink infused with the life essence that they've drained from the victims. And it sort of positions Hump as this science fiction vampire, which I really, really like. It's such a interesting idea to me. You know, I am a big vampires fan. I think that they're a very fun concept because they are so over the top and dramatic. I think that there's a lot you can do with them. And for this to sort of now skew into a little science fiction aspect as well and sort of be like, oh, I'm draining people of their essence through science and potions? Oh, baby, that's exactly what I like.
Dude, yeah, absolutely. It's like kind of, I mean, I know it's the 60s. I know that they've had like a few decades of source material to work off of here, but it's kind of shocking like how well they're able to just like fold in every good idea. You know?
Definitely.
They really nail it. The other thing that I love about this moment, I actually think it's a really good character detail of introducing him that way in like a strong narrative sense. And in addition to establishing him as a mad science vampire, which I love. I never thought about it from that perspective. But it also just like right away shows you like, this guy's crazy. Like, on screen, it's a scientist wandering around his spooky lab drinking smoking chemicals. You know, like, we got it immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. He and his nurse begin to visit the drugged, kidnapped victims, observing their actions, talking about aphrodisiac dosage and way to keep them placated. The hippies are grouped together and can keep their grass. The lesbians get their own room. This is one of the moments where I think the dubbing does improve the movie. It is very, very silent in Venganza del Sexo.
Yeah.
For example, they just kind of observe these new arrivals in these moments.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to be, like, sort of talking around what they're doing and just sort of alluding totally. To it, I think really works.
Absolutely. And I actually think it's a pretty good performance in this sequence. And I think mm-hmm. it's a really interesting sequence. We kind of have glossed over, I think, how unbelievably horny the first, like, 15 minutes of this movie is and, like, how unrelenting it is. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, the one character you mentioned who's stumbling around on the street is literally the only person on camera in the first 15 minutes who's not making out or getting naked or fucking or something. And then you've got 15 minutes of that hard cut to this dude just, like, totally cold, totally disaffected,
yeah,
dropping out the soundtrack. You know, it's like this really stark contrast that I think is really works.
Absolutely. You know, you've felt the passion and the heat, which makes the coldness and severity of Dr. Hump that much more visceral. You know, totally. When he visits this next patient and he just, like, looks her up and down, totally... The only indication that there's any kind of stimulus is the soundtrack that has this fucking, like, sproinging noise that is, like, a theme, a motif that comes back to be like, you should be getting horny right now.
Thanks, man. I do need the instruction.
Yeah. The final visit is to the nymphomaniac. She's masturbating once again, and Dr. Hump grimly says, let's see how she does with a man, and walks out. Leaving the nurse to prepare gross. As well. It is. It's fucking gross and disturbing. And I think that it does such a really good job. You know, not only is he, like, scary because he's walking around drinking his own potions and you go, wow, that's crazy. But he is, like, brutal right away. Yeah. You're like, this is a scary dude.
Cold and sadistic. Yeah.
Yeah. Back at the newspaper office, George is approached by the local barkeep, who says the day Rachel the stripper was taken, he saw a big guy in a mask, the kind of guy you'd never forget and wouldn't want to see again.
It's like the one time they acknowledge that he looks weird.
The sex experiments begin, the man and woman are put into bed together and come to life after drinking some aphrodisiac potion. Hump watches from a video monitor in his lab. Some really nice shots of them in the background with the steaming flask helping to make that framing interesting, along with sort of covering up the insert body double nature of this shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just again, really did such a solid job of covering up the recycled aspect, right? I mean, the fact that he even cared enough to put some flasks in the way to be like, yeah, it's the same lab. Like,
it's crazy. He's making the effort. Like, yeah. It really, you don't see that very often.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I think something else that starts to kind of get established at this point in the movie, maybe in a couple of minutes, but we learn that Dr. Hump is sick. He's got this scene where he's covering his face with his hand. There's like That's some right. weird, like, rotting skin or something. And, you know, kind of thinking about these, like, cabin in the woods, like, rules for horror movies idea, I think what the Dr. Hump cut is starting to establish at this point is this interesting dynamic where, like, you know, in the slasher movie, being too horny gets you killed. In this one, being too horny gets you kidnapped.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, being entirely uninterested and disaffected and cold makes you, like, physically sick. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting dynamic.
Definitely. And to me, in that moment where he is almost sort of reacting to what he's watching on screen, right? And so it almost feels like they are pulling at some humanity, and that part of what's making him feel sick is this sort of being pulled back from the mad scientist walls that he's put up or whatever. And this does almost sort of, like, send him over the edge. His hand demonstrates that rapid aging,
mm-hmm.
and he has to sort of get a timely glass of life force juice to bring himself back from the brink. And he says, and I thought this was such an interesting pivotal line that really just makes it, like, puts a timer on it, where he says, the effect is dissipating at least 10 minutes faster now. I'll mm-hmm. need stronger doses more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just such a good way to sort of establish stakes. Now, he mm-hmm. has a timer, yeah. which means that their lives are in danger.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Something else that really stood out to me in this scene where he's watching and reacting, I think that's, again, one of the better performance moments in the movie, where what he's projecting on his face and his posture, you kind of can't tell if he's, like, disgusted by the act of coitus that he's watching, or if he's disgusted by his own arousal, or what's going on with it. And then he starts to kind of like, not exactly convulse, but he starts to become like physically upset. And this is going to be my last David Lynch reference.
No, keep him coming. You know, I love him.
But that moment kind of reminded me of in Blue Velvet when he's putting the mask on and you don't know what the fuck he's up to or what he's getting into, but it's this really physical performance that just kind of leaves you with questions.
Right. The fact that you don't know what's in the canister means that you don't know what he's feeling, and that variable is exactly what makes it scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point.
The male victim can't stand any more extractions after reaching climax twice already and is deemed useless. Dispose of the
toss
body.
Toss him in the incinerator, man. Get rid of that. Get rid of that useless hunk.
The callousness is reinforced as the nurse begs for him to treat them a little more kindly and says, "You can use my body instead." And he throws her to the ground and says, "You can't give your body to me because I already own it. And don't worry, I intend to include you in due time." This dude is fucking scary.
Yeah, dude, this is for me where they really establish like how cruel he is, you know? And it's interesting once you have that moment where you're not sure, like, is he aroused? Is he disgusted? Is he both? You know, building that into this dialogue here for the cruelty, I think it's great, man. I think it's like solid character work.
Absolutely. The body is cremated by a monster who spots Rachel watching him. Love at first sight for this fella, and leads to a leads to a fun little transition as it shifts to the barkeep confirming the drawing of the sketch artist is the entity that he saw. And he thought it was a mask, but with the story clipping from the previous mad scientist, they're no longer sure. "Publish that picture," orders the inspector.
Dude, do publish that picture, because that drawing is so fucking good.
Yes.
It's so cool. Like, it looks like Frankenstein, but not Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And it's, man, publish it.
Yeah. That's a classic Frankenstein.
Yeah, totally.
Now, the story about the mad scientist is interesting because in Venganza del Sexo, the article is vague enough to possibly be about Hump himself and not necessarily say that, yes, it is a specifically somebody else mad scientist. They also indicate that they're an extremist from Poland whose 30-year timeline from the original release in 1966 would heavily imply that he's one of the Nazis that escaped to Argentina, which would also explain the eugenics improve the human race angle of the whole thing.
Totally, so, man. That actually puts a lot of things that are coming make a lot of sense with that detail.
Right. And back at Hump headquarters, he's probing one of these monsters looking for the nerve that controls the libido, the key to sexual desire, which he'll use to preserve his life and heighten sexual stimulus. But first, he needs more drugs, and so another monster goes out to fill a prescription, which is the funniest idea in the world to me.
Dude, it is hilarious. It's so funny. To really seal the deal on the punchline here, the pharmacist then calls like the police or the reporter or whatever, and he literally says, "A monster just came in and filled a prescription." Fuck yeah. Come on, dude.
And what makes that moment even better is that he has to like check the reference picture again to confirm.
Yeah, dude. He does the double take. Oh, so good, man.
It's so good. And it's also one of the only moments when Hump feels relatable, where you're like, oh yeah, if I had an army of fucking weird ass automatons, there's no way I'd be running to the pharmacy.
Yeah, true. Good point. Yeah. Yeah.
So this pharmacist does snitch. He calls George to run over there right away. After all, the monster is getting antsy out there. And suddenly, the druggist is cowering in fear after George hangs up. The monster reports back and Hump is furious. "These damn cops won't stop me," he swears. "This is for the benefit of the world!" But the police can't find any prints on the corpse. He seems to have been struck by a blunt instrument. Or attacked by something inhuman, George is quick to add. He's like the most annoying little brother.
Yeah, totally, totally. And this is one of those moments, I mean, it really it has all these sci-fi and horror elements, but it really is a genre-bending piece when it's all put together. But this is one of those, like, very, very traditional, like, B-movie, monster movie genre moments. You know, you got, like, the one reporter who already understands everything that's going on, and he's trying to convince everyone around him, you know?
Definitely. Yeah, it really works, I think, as far as just sort of propelling the plot. It's simple, but it gets you going.
Mm-hmm.
The inspector is frustrated. He says, crazy or not, someone eating drugs doesn't send a monster to the drugstore. How wrong you are, inspector.
Dude, I don't know what the fuck that means. What is that supposed to mean? Crazy or not, someone eating drugs doesn't send a monster to a drugstore?
You don't send a monster to a man's
exactly
job.
That sounds exactly like
that's
what a crazy person would do.
That's why he didn't get the drugs, because you sent a monster to do a man's job.
Got it. Okay, yeah, yeah. Well, either way, man, my one note, for, I did write down that whole quote, and my note was just perfect.
Yeah. I also love, it cuts to another monster hilariously strumming a guitar while the patients on the pump's compound wander around the garden, all except the lesbians who are having sex in their room. Very funny scene, weird juxtaposition, another sort of obvious insert shot, but it really sort of lends to this strange dreamlike atmosphere. It doesn't feel totally. Like I'm sitting here like, oh, I'm getting fucking randy. I'm there like, this is weird, and I am unsettled.
Yeah, and that like three-piece sequence of monster just came in for a prescription, crazy guy doesn't send a monster to get a prescription, cut to monster playing guitar.
Yeah.
It is incredible. It just is like, you're talking before, I think before we hit record, that it's a very cozy movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's sequences like that, man. It just like, it just feels good to watch.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Hump's experiments are going awry without his ingredients, and suddenly he's talking to the brain in the jar, which is the mad scientist.
40 minutes in, dude. 40 minutes before you tell me the brain can talk?
I also like that he does, like, compliment Sandwich, where he's like, you've been doing a great job carrying out my experiments, but you gotta be more careful.
Yeah, and I, you know, something that I really like about this too, on this watch, I feel like this starts to kind of hint at establishing that Dr. Hump is actually a fucking moron. Like, he thinks he's a genius, but he's so stupid.
Yeah.
And we start to get that hint here. And that's kind of what I was referencing with that, you know, the Nazi connotations there, where it's like got this huge idea of himself, but actually he's a moron.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. I think that that's exactly it. You know, he thinks that he's the one in charge, even when he is basically the automaton to this brain in the jar. Like,
yeah, right.
He is just the tool that this guy is using.
Yeah, and not to, I think it's safe to say this right now, not to to jump too far ahead, but I think we later reveal that the brain is an even bigger idiot who thinks he's an even bigger genius.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
And they just are entirely relying on each other to establish that they're both the smartest guys in the room, you know?
That's right. It's a Matryoshka doll of idiot Nazis.
In our fucking horny monster movie. Oh, man. That's the good stuff.
Yeah.
Also, I cannot let this go by without mentioning this Dutch angle when he's talking to the brain.
Oh,
and it's, dude, it's like full, like, James Whale, Bride of Frankenstein. It just doesn't get better, man.
Oh, yeah. It's nice. It's real nice. And he says, I have to do it. I have to send these monsters to the drugs. But as we see, the police are laying a trap at the pharmacy. This is also where we see the cameo from our director as the regular guy just picking up his medicine. I love that the George, the newspaper man, like, looks over when that guy leaves, like, was that the monster? The guy looks back and shakes his head.
Well,
like,
nobody can tell. Nobody can tell if the monster's a monster or not. So, like, fair question.
It's also a really fun subversion, though, when it seems like George has hit the jackpot, but the ominous figure is Hump himself, not a monster. So instead, they simply fill the prescription. I was totally taken by surprise the first time.
Dude, and there's another, like, incredible, accidental, like, genius narrative beat there, where he calls the police, And the he's checking in. He's like, anything suspicious yet? No, not yet. And the police is like, just wait. Somebody will show up. The second he hangs up the phone, somebody shows up.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
It's immediate, dude. He's like, wait around about half a second. You know?
George is suspicious of Hump and tails him. He seems to vanish into thin air. And so George does call it in. He's told to continue the search by the inspector. The great reporter, he says sarcastically, which is fucking burn on this guy. He's like, oh, you won't put any fucking footwork into this?
Yeah. The police are doing nothing. They're just letting this guy go and then roasting him.
Sure enough, though, George finds the compound. And he clambers over the wall right into the guard unit of monsters with attack dogs. Very so funny sick. Image.
And I was watching this, I couldn't help just be like, what if I wore that sweater to work?
You'd they look have these, like a fucking baller, dude.
it's like a knit sweater that has like a turtleneck that goes all the way up around the head, so just the face is revealed.
He's doing like the Cornholio, but with a knit sweater.
Yeah, totally. Just showing up, 9 a.m.
What's up, guys? You like my new look? It's retro. It's from 1970.
Yeah.
He is captured. There was a moment in the car where Hump seemed to look back and notice, but doesn't say anything. And I assume he got back and told them to expect company. It's a nice little touch that isn't super obvious. Does work.
That cut from the super close-up into George's face and then cutting to him waking up tied to the bed, I thought was actually kind of a nice, you know, nuanced is maybe not the right word, but kind of a softer touch than the rest of the movie.
Definitely. Yeah, they went to the effort to do sort of a match shot.
Yeah.
And he awakens in this room with Rachel, who fills him in quite succinctly before they fake being chill as the nurse comes in. And while the nurse does her thing, Rachel ethers her. Just great. It was that simple.
Yeah, they just keep that in the room with all the patients. Perfect. Safe.
Yeah, that's a terrible decision on their part. And again, more evidence for the fact that these are dumbasses upon
dumbasses. Just a total idiot, yeah.
Now freed, George and Rachel attempt to flee, but there's a monster that comes in, and just when you think it's all over for them, he presents Rachel with a flower.
Which is honestly, like, the sweetest, most genuine display of affection we've seen this entire movie.
Absolutely. Hey.
Giving us our Frankenstein moment.
The man is the monster, and the monster is the man.
Oh, shit.
When he goes to check on George, she lures the monster away and out the door, and the nurse starts talking in her sleep, a sex dream about Hump. And she's so warped from the ether that when she awakes, she sees Hump in George's place and makes a move. And George goes, hey, I could get used to this being captured business.
Fucking A. Yeah, he does, dude. And my note on that is like, has he already been affected by the aphrodisiac or is he just a fucking creep?
I think he's like, just a creep.
I think so, man.
He does the Rodney Dangerfield necktie thing. He goes, hey, I'm straight ready to up, go in dude. Here.
Man, it's, you know, and he's like a chill guy up until now, and then like the moment he's around a woman, he just fucking shows it's his true colors here.
You only saw him around men up to that point.
So. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, one of my notes around this time is like, is Dr. Hump actually more charismatic than George? Like,
in the aftermath, the nurse comes too. Pun not intended, but accepted.
Right? Yeah, definitely.
Recognizing that he isn't Hump, but is still infatuated with him. And so she's going to help George escape, though insisting he's misjudging Hump. She goes to fetch Hump and says George has been given the serum. Meanwhile, the police are setting up the search, hopeful they'll reach George before he's turned into a monster. Sparks fly around a really fun framed shot in the lab as Hump tells George and Rachel that they're about to participate in an experiment where they'll have non-contact sex. The power of their connection via libido so intense that they are, quote, unable to stop screwing, as George so eloquently puts it mentally to her.
This shit could not be more 60s.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, so, so of its time.
And the nurse is in the mix, too, and suddenly all the other patients we've seen, gang's all there.
Yeah, and is this, we're talking about the part where they're strapped down to the table, and we're getting into the sequence here?
Yeah. Sex dominates the world, cries Hump, and now I dominate sex!
that's the best. It's the best, you know? And there's a moment there where I'm like, oh, that's actually like kind of a novel approach to world domination. Mm-hmm. Like control everyone's sex and then you control everyone, sure. You know? But honestly, that's I didn't even realize until talking about it again. That's not his plan at all. His plan is just to harvest it for his vampire, you know, his little vampire juice and just keep himself going. You
that's
know?
Right. That's right.
This whole sequence, man, when he walks on screen and you have that profile shot of him taking up like half the frame, very comic book, looks yes. incredible. We've got like textbook, picture perfect, mad science gear all over the fucking place. And then this sequence, I think, really exemplifies the experimental and collage aspects of this movie. I think it drags a little bit. It's of its time. It's definitely this movie, but I really think this is a cool and creative and like effective sequence.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's the first time that they've sort of really, since the opening introduction to Hump, leaned into the sort of mad science aspect of it. And totally. It's nice that they do that again, that they don't just have it be kind of a one-and-done thing, especially because they're like, well, we are a low-budget thing, so let's just fucking, like, leave it all on the floor, right? We're gonna fucking do this sequence. We're gonna make it the best fucking sequence we can if we're not gonna be able to just sprinkle it all throughout.
Yeah, and throughout this movie, a lot of these cut-ins, I don't think this is a cut-in, if I'm remembering right. I think this is from the original Vengaza cut. But throughout the cut-ins, I noticed the sound design on this, like, it just sounds like experimental radio or something. Yeah. Like it's this really heavily layered, like you've got Forbidden Planet synths and like you said, like a clicking pen and these sort of classic like monster movie echoing bell motifs.
I heard a Glockenspiel at one point.
Yeah, it's awesome, man. Yeah. It's really cool.
The extraction ends and Hump says he's going to take from them again tomorrow. George is strong and he knows how to use what he's got, says Hump. I said, hell yeah, dude.
Hell yeah, brother.
The strength from their passion will nourish my body better than the others. And I love the fisheye close-up on his face as the scene ends. Ugh, that's good shit.
Good shit.
George and Rachel confess their love for each other in the garden, though he's perturbed by her having been made into a nymphomaniac. I'm not jealous.
A real
I'm just,
asshole, man.
Just you worried about who's going to get used in the tests.
Yeah, that's what you're concerned about. Yeah.
Yeah, Rachel is very, like, sort of level-headed. She's like, there are women like me all around the fucking world, dude. Chill out.
Dude, yeah, and it's really interesting. The American edit of it really becomes this sort of, like, it revolves around the conflict between this free love and this coming, like, summer of love movement versus this very, like, heavily repressed, like, Nazi sexuality.
Right.
Really interesting way of taking that original idea and pivoting it for this specific audience.
Right. That night, George escapes his room and goes investigating. First, he peeps on some sex, though.
Don't mind if I do.
Yeah. He says, oh, the nymphomaniac and a guy with a very funny and distracting tattoo of a face on his arm. How did they know that's my king?
Hell yeah.
Then he hides from the monster in the room of the hippie group sex, and they don't snitch. Out of sight, man, the smoker says, which is funny because it's both literal and the idiom.
Yeah, hell and yeah, also dude. I love the monster coming in and watching this hippie orgy and just like, nothing to see here. Perfectly normal, you know? I'm just looking for this other guy.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. Next, he finds the lab. Some severed heads hanging in a closet, which is
the
so
best, dude.
Funny and bizarre. Oh, Mr. Fancy Pants. One spare head isn't enough. This guy needs two?
Millions over here. Yeah, just on like a B-movie level, this scene is complete with visible wires.
Yeah.
You know? Dude, that's how you do it.
The note reveals that the mad doctor is in the jar, and it warns George, Hump is on the verge of world domination. Try to stop him, and you'll die. He writes something down and hides as someone approaches, and the steady clomping is effective sound design, in my opinion. It's really eerie. Like, it really, especially since that very first moment really lingers in your memory, it's very evocative. You, without even seeing it, you do almost see it just from the audio. Turns out not to be the monster, though. It's the nurse. She warns George to escape tonight, and he says, "Damn it, everyone has got to escape. Rachel, the lesbians, those in the continuous orgy, the couple going down on each other." Such a funny list to rattle off. He's like, "I need to mention everyone that I saw."
Well, if you forgot what you were horny about between when you saw it and just now, this is your little reminder.
Yeah. He sends the nurse to the club with a note for the police, though she's disappointed at the prospect of his staying with Rachel. She hands it to the barkeep, and there's a really nicely shot moment of following him, following her for a moment before calling it in. Just really great stuff. The note was directions to the compound. But when the police arrive at the club to check it out, they find him dead.
Oh, my God.
What the hell? Hump is on to them, and he has the nurse chained up, coldly furious at her betrayal while George is restrained by the monsters. And he said he's going to make her a blindly obedient monster like the others. George is furious and removed from the room once the deed is done. "Your libido experiments are criminal," he shouts. "I hope you rot in hell." And as George and Rachel are led to their experiment chamber, he reveals the true plan to her. Knowing that they'd be stuck here and put in the experiment, they switched the fluids, and now these two haven't actually taken the aphrodisiac. "We only have to pretend we did, so let's start making love," George says, just sweating profusely. "Oh, we better do it anyway."
Yeah, I know. I also love, like, because this is another, like, classic genre beat, right? Like, play cool, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But because it's this movie, playing cool is, we need to start, you know, we got to get into this.
Yeah. The impassive faces of a monster, Hump, and the nurse all watch these two getting busy. It's really an interesting sort of cool-a-shop effect in action, yeah. The coolness, this direct contrast to the heat and moans of passion.
Yeah, man, totally blank expressions. And I think they're really milking that Dutch angle in all those shots, too. Mm-hmm. It really works.
That's right. And the final shoe drops. They hit a gun in here, and now George has got it. Clear-minded enough to stop what he's doing and grab it, he shoots at the monster. To no effect! Totally useless plan.
Yeah, man. And that scene where he grabs the gun, like the movement of it, the way the body moves through the frame and is positioned, super comic booky, super like maybe even like 40s, mm-hmm. you know, really just familiar, comfortable, love to see it movie making.
Absolutely. I also love that this monster knocks out George with like a chop to the throat. It's so fucking funny. It also kills the nurse and frees Rachel against the direct orders of Hump? What
yeah.
the hell?
He's in love, man.
Whoa. Police sirens indicate that they finally found the compound, and there's this big shootout in the yard as the monsters approach fearlessly. George warns them to stop, though, because they might shoot a prisoner. Besides, they need to rescue Rachel. And they find the two escapees running away downriver, and the police quickly shoot the monster down. Genuinely heartbreaking and tragic as he spins towards Rachel and silently indicates both love and anguish before falling in and sinking below the somehow smoking water.
Yeah, man, and I think it's earlier, a couple minutes before this, in the escape scene, George grabs like a little vial of acid and throws it in, or no, is that, that's coming up.
It's coming
he throws
right
it
up.
In Hump's face. Yeah, another moment of just like, you gotta have acid in the face, man. It needs to be in this movie.
Yeah. They return in to the compound to sort of confront Hump, and he reveals mm-hmm. that he was the first victim of the mad scientist in Italy,
mm-hmm.
and that the potent lovemaking forces that can literally create life can also preserve it. I do like that even though the brain was like, oh, yeah, you've been doing a great job, you're doing a good job of mm-hmm. sort of carrying on my work. It's interesting that Hump is so much more effective as a tool than the automatons that he has created. And so
yeah,
there's, I think,
point.
An interesting gap between, like, this is diminishing, and, like, it's not something that is feasible for them to accomplish mm-hmm. here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which really works, again, with that Nazi undertone.
Right, right. Hump shows no pain as George tries to take him down, choking him and seemingly a moment away from victory. Until Rachel is the ultimate savior, stabbing him in the back several times, literally and figuratively.
And it looks very realistic.
Mm-hmm. And that is the death of that actor.
No, she's like got a screwdriver just like poking it into already red dots or something. Yeah. It's classic B-movie making.
That's right. And now our duo look on with the dispassionate faces as Hump's face ages quickly, though they do wind up getting grossed out by the end. But it is kind of a nice reversal of before, of like now they're the ones on the opposite end of it.
Yeah, and it's a great like overlay, like Wolfman transformation sequence of him like melting and rotting away.
Yeah, yeah, the different plates that they sort of use to make that work. It's great stuff. And the brain curses them out. Really fucking funny ending. He's like, good job, dumbasses. We were going to unlock eternal life for all humanity. But now, because we were connected, I'm dead too. And he grunts and the brain jar lights on fire. And he just goes out screaming, forever you will be mortal!
Yeah, dude, brain in a jar on fire, you know? Mm-hmm. They just keep up in the ante here.
That's right. It works really, really well. And now, Pete,
so sick.
We've reached the part of the episode where we sum up why this isn't just a good horror movie, but is, in fact, the best horror movie ever made. And I'm going to let you start.
Well, I'll give it a shot. I honestly didn't have as much time as I would hope to put together a clever answer to this. But I think this movie is a perfect distillation of all of the genre elements that make horror movies fun. I think it has a surprising amount of subtext, which in my opinion is kind of essential to a great horror movie. You can't go in expecting it. It's got to sneak up on you, you know?
Mm-hmm. To me, though, this is the best horror movie ever made because I think that it's just an absolutely fascinating example of sort of how a movie can both represent where it came from and also be completely of its time and also be completely forward thinking.
Totally
spans this sort of weird dichotomy of like, yeah, all of that great gothic horror is in there, right? It feels like a Frankenstein movie. It feels like even a 40s or 50s sort of atomic sci-fi vampire thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then for it to have that and then to incorporate the sexual revolution that's happening and the changing sort of ethics of sexuality in society, not only represented on screen, but also to sort of just be that, right? As a 1966 and then 1970 sexploitation movie, it's sort of the form and function are one and the same. It is such a incredible example of like, any flaws that you could like pin on this movie are actually the things that make it good. those pieces of it give it texture and give it character and represent the larger subgenre that it fits into. And I think that for it to, I don't want to say sort of transcend sexploitation because I don't think that it's like some garbage heap to sort of be lifted out of. But I think that it does transcend it from a mainstream audience perspective, right? That somebody who is maybe not interested in sexploitation or turned off by the idea of it, this would be a really awesome way to sort of give them an example of how it can work and not necessarily just be like this uncomfortably horny thing. Because even though the movie is horny, it does have that sort of tone of innocence as well, where like, you know, everybody is kind of just like, maybe it's the black and white photography that gives it that old timey feel, but it just doesn't feel incredibly sexualized to me, even when they are literally having sex on screen.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, more titties than you could shake a stick at, if that's your thing.
Yeah. Also, we totally skipped over it, but in one of the early scenes, in addition to all these titties throughout the entire film, we get just incredible photo collage, like literal paste up on the wall of a hunk wall.
Yeah,
it's just naked men strategically cropped to not get censored out, and that's the scene where the woman's masturbating with that vibrator you mentioned.
Right.
But man, that hunk wall, I think, really goes a long way to breaking up some of the like hetero monotony that a lot of these movies suffer from.
Yeah.
They don't really come back to it later in the movie, but I really like those little moments, man. They really stand out and make this movie shine.
Definitely. I would say even the fact that there is like a lesbian couple in it, yes, they might have totally. Been put in to titillate, but also right. like it does just help to have like a diverse cast of characters, and they are distinct and interesting, and like they are all a different person.
Yeah, it's acknowledging this as a reality of sexual experience yeah. for human beings,
right?
You know,
absolutely. And hey, if that doesn't make this the best horror movie ever made, I don't know what the fuck does.
Hell yeah. Well, I think this movie's really a shining example of getting more than you signed up for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, as thinking about this analogy a little bit, it's definitely kind of a half-baked movie,
mm-hmm.
right? Most of the ideas that we're coming up with here are we're bringing to this film, and I don't think they're making too much of an effort for. Some of it I think they are, most of it I think they aren't. That's very common with this kind of movie, especially sexploitation and especially just exploitation movies in genre. Most of the time you just get a half-baked movie, but this one comes with instructions of like, pop it in the oven for an hour,
yeah.
you know? It fucking rules, man.
Absolutely, absolutely. It does rule. And Pete, we now reached plug time, and your comics rule. I want to encourage people to support you, to buy your comics. Please tell them where they can find your comics and do just that.
Yeah, best thing is to get after me on Instagram. So the Instagram handle is @the_stink_hole. Very embarrassing to say out loud, but you know what? We set it up 10 years ago and we're not going to change. I have a store, Envy. It's the same address. You can get at it from the links in the bio there. And while I'm here, I'm just going to go ahead and plug A.T. Pratt as well.
Hell yeah.
The guy is incredible. He's played a role in getting me over here, and that rules.
Oh, yeah. He's one of the best out there. Not only an incredible friend, but also a truly incredible artist. He did the poster for the first 100 movies covered on Decibel Horror House in Philly. And it is like, it sits on my wall, and every day I'm like, the best thing that I did with this show was like prompt this incredible work of art. Like the fact that that happened from it means that the show was a success, in my opinion. So,
well, and that was a major stepping stone, I think, in him establishing himself of a master of horror.
That's exactly so. Right. Yes, it did make him the master of horror. So I do take a little credit in that. but certainly it's all him, and he is incredible. So definitely check that out. You can support them both at the same time by picking up that awesome double issue that I mentioned earlier. It's very, very funny. Two wonderful Western stories. A lot of great art in there. And yeah, it's just great stuff.
Yeah, I think you can get that one from me. If I'm remembering right, I think Andy sold out of that one, and I'm down to probably my last like 25 copies or so.
Boy,
so
better get after, you know, it
get,
quick,
get it if you're interested. Yeah.
As far as my plugs, people, check out the back catalog. I mentioned up top, this is the best podcast for comics fans out there. And that was no joke, folks. There is a murderer's row of comics artists and writers that have been on this podcast, and I highly encourage you all to go check out. Corinne Helbert was on talking about Possession. Lonnie Nadler was just on talking about Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah, that was a great episode.
Jenna Cha, his wife, talking about Night of the Hunter. Michael DeForge talking about The Happening. AT himself talking about Eraserhead. You know, just so many awesome artists who have given generously of their time, and I want to thank them all, and thank you, Pete, for coming on the show, because this was really an awesome conversation, and I feel like a lot of the comics heads, they always bring an interesting choice, man. They give me a lot to chew on, and I love that about it.
Well, I definitely appreciate that, and I need to extend a thank you to you as well. One, you did an incredible job putting history together for this movie. I did a little bit of Googling prior to the episode, and I was like, boy, I don't know how much he's going to be able to dig up here. But goddamn, if you didn't find it. And also just like huge shout out for getting comics people on here and you know, giving people a chance to get on here and get their name out there and
yeah.
talk about something that's not comics, because that always ends up being an interesting conversation.
Hell yeah, man. Absolutely love that. So yeah, check out the back catalog. All kinds of great stuff. It's not just comics, though. Lots of great comedy people out there as well. Lots of great just people who are my friends, and they are great and worth checking out as well. I'm basically done promoting the Patreon, because as you may have seen in various places now at this point, the show is sadly coming to an end in October. So there is, the Patreon is still up. There will still be bonus episodes happening until the end, but do not feel super compelled to go over there, because ultimately all of the bonus episodes will wind up on the main feed, because there was a lot of great stuff that happened behind that paywall, and I would feel insane if I just let it go fallow there.
So. That Synecdoche episode you just put up was good as fuck, dude.
Thank you.
It's
thank
so
you.
Good.
Yes, great movie. Michael Swaim, really, he incredible. What a guy. Very intelligent in terms of, like, yeah, making it not only interesting to listen to, but, like, holy shit, bringing so much depth of philosophical knowledge and shit to it. Mm-hmm. Really, really awesome. Mm-hmm. So yeah, go check that out. Go check out the back catalog. Hey, leave a rating and a review if you want to give this a nice sort of finish.
Might as well, man.
I think we're at like 90 reviews or something like that on iTunes. So hey, if you want to bump us over 100 by the end of the show, that would be sick. All right, that's it, everyone. Thanks. Bye.